WFWB News Talk 980. This is Dr. Chambers on Call. I'm Dr. Chambers. Talk Radio is Medicine. We have a special show for you today. In studio, I have Dr. Barry Friedberg. Dr. Friedberg is a nationally renowned anesthetist. Sometimes I get confused where I am, what audience I'm talking to. In America, it's probably anesthesiologist. Anyhow, Dr. Friedberg is in studio. We will be talking to him about the standards of 21st century anesthesia. And why is that important to you? Well, in the 20th century, a lot of people were dying from surgery, and anesthetists got their act together. They invented all kinds of stuff, heart monitors, oxygen monitors. The 21st century is a little bit more complex. And now we're going to bring in our guest, Dr. Barry Friedberg. Dr. Friedberg's practiced anesthesia for over 30 years. He's a national expert in anesthesia, and he's going to talk about the standards of anesthesia in the 21st century. Dr. Friedberg has written a number of books. The book that we're talking about today is Getting Over Going Under. And it's about anesthesia. It's about the things that you need to know before you let your anesthetist put you to sleep. And I use that word kind of, well, anesthetists don't really put people to sleep, do they, Dr. Friedberg?
No, it's a very much more complex situation.
So before we get into that, I thought we would just take a little bit of a look at how anesthesia came about. Because we remember way back, even before I was born, say at the Battle of Waterloo, there were a lot of problems, a lot of wounded soldiers. And the trick was, if you had to do an amputation, you had to do it quickly. And I think we chatted about this off the air. How many seconds did a surgeon have?
A good surgeon was considered making the grade if he went 7 seconds to amputate your leg.
7 seconds to cut your leg. I mean, that takes longer for me to break off the leg from a Kentucky Fried Chicken. So what has changed since that time? Why is it that now we can let the surgeons go in there and operate for hours? It's really about anesthesia.
Yes, it is about anesthesia. Both the advance in medications that we're using and the monitors that we use.
Okay, so in anesthesia, let's talk about it in broad terms. We've got a general anesthetic that a lot of people are familiar with. You count back to 10, they put something in your lungs and they're breathing for you, and then you wake up and you got this big ache in your belly or whatever it is. That's kind of general anesthesia.
Yes.
And the next group, the other part that you mentioned in your book was when you had your own spinal surgery, you had an epidural. Now tell us what this epidural means.
Well, epidural, most of the childbearing ladies are familiar with, is a pain-killing anesthetic in your back. It's similar to spinal anesthesia, but slightly different. And this was actually for my hip replacement, and this is what got me started on the foundation of the book.
So when we're talking epidural, I don't quite know what that term means.
There's a sac of spinal fluid, and the membrane around this fluid is called the dural membrane. So a spinal anesthetic is a subdural anesthetic, and an epidural, the medication is put on the outside of this dural sac.
So basically, the nerves in our body that control everything, that control pain and how we're perceiving the world, runs down the back of our spine, and there's a lot of fluid around it. And an anesthetist will put some magic stuff in there so that we don't feel any pain, and we can operate on the hip or deliver a baby by C-section.
Correct.
C-section, of course, being cesarean section. Okay, so we have general, we have epidural, and then we have kind of local anesthesia. And what's that about? What do you mean by local anesthesia?
Well, local anesthesia is typically where anesthetic is injected into the tissues in the operative field.
For instance, if I have a problem with my finger, you're going to inject into what part of my body to do that?
Well, we could inject at the base of the digit, we could inject at the wrist, at the elbow, or in your axilla of the armpit.
What will happen to my finger?
It will become numb. First it'll hurt, and then it'll become numb.
Kind of what the dentist does to me when I go there?
Precisely.
But you know, the dentist, they always say, it's not going to hurt, and it always hurts.
They mean it's not going to hurt them when they put the injection in. We also have intravenous sedation, which is what I specialize in.
So here we have now these classifications, the general, the epidural, and the local. Now, you know, most of us listening to the show, I think pretty much everybody listening to the show, was born in the 20th century. And there were great strides in anesthesia in the 20th century. And I thought before we get into what we need to do in the 21st century, we talk a little bit about what happened in the 20th century. And in your book, you have this great term that everything in the 20th century was below the neck. Maybe you could explain that to us.
Well, when you go into the operating room, all the monitors they put on your body typically are this three sticky patches for the electrocardiogram. They're on your chest. They check your blood pressure. It's on your arm. They check your oxygen sensations on your fingertip. All of those are bodily functions that have nothing to do with what patients really ask us, which is, look, doc, I don't want to lecture on anesthesia. I just don't want to hear it, feel it, or remember it.
The big issue, I mean, people often wonder, It's one of those stories I have in med school about appendicitis. And there's like 200 lists in the book of the cause of appendicitis and the mistaken diagnosis. And when you're in med school, you always laugh at this because you go like, who's going to make those mistakes? But as you get older, you realize that appendicitis is a dangerous one to miss. And it's the most common reason that primary care doctors get sued. The reason that we're all so much worried about it is that you die if it's not fixed. And if you go back to like 50 or 70 years ago, a lot of people died of appendicitis, but don't die now. Why is that?
Mostly it's because of antibiotics and better diagnostics. But when you talk about 50 years ago, one of the things that I was shocked to learn is that we lost more people due to anesthesia in the 1950s than we lost to the great polio epidemic.
Well, that's really puts it in perspective. So when we say we lost them from anesthesia, it means that if they had an appendix and we were worried about it and we had to operate, they weren't going to die from the surgery. They were dying from our inability to put them to sleep, so to speak, and wake up again.
Yes, 1 in 10,000 would die as a result of anesthesia in the 1950s. It was a staggering, staggering statistic.
So in the 20th century, then, the focus was on that you live through your surgery.
Precisely. We have transformed the risk of anesthesia from dying at 1 in 10,000 to the 1 in 200, 250,000, which is a lot safer than the ride in the car to get the anesthetic.
Well, and the other thing that I think anesthesias did really great in the 20th century was we went from really taking people who were relatively low risk and having that great success rate, but we also looked at very high risk people, like the elderly, people who were 70 or 80 plus.
Correct. You almost never hear the expression, the patient was denied surgery because they were too sick to tolerate the anesthetic. We were able to anesthetize virtually anybody for any surgery now.
Well, see, I think that anesthesiologists and orthopedic surgeons are like the unsung heroes of modern medicine. Say, 10 years or 20 years before I went to medical school, you broke your hip, you were put in bed for several months. The chances were you got a pneumonia, you got a clot, you tended not to do well or die.
Yes.
Okay, so the surgery came about, and they had these fantastic surgeons that developed these techniques, but it was the anesthesia that allowed them to do it on these older patients. Is that
precisely
right?
Absolutely correct.
Okay. So in the 20th century, the main problems we saw were this. We had heart problems, so we brought in these monitors that could watch the heart rhythm.
Yes.
Okay. And then the next thing we did was, when did these pulse oximeters, these things come in?
1984 was the first commercially available pulse oximeter.
And we better bring in all our listeners in. What is a pulse oximeter and what does it do?
It's the little beeping device you saw on Tony Soprano's finger in the series. And it tells you that the patient's body has enough oxygen in it, but more importantly, the tone goes down as the oxygen level goes down, so the anesthesiologist is able to intervene and prevent damage from lack of oxygen.
So, by the way, I was a big fan of Sopranos, but the medical scenes in it were so badly written and researched, they made me cringe. I think the gangster things were much better researched, but then I'm not a gangster. How would I know? So we're in the studio today with Dr. Barry Friedberg. Dr. Friedberg is a renowned expert on anesthesia. We're talking about the 21st century problems in anesthesia, and we're going to be getting to those when we come back from the break. You're listening to Dr. Chambers on Call. I am Dr. Chambers, Talk Radio's Medicine. We'll be right back. KFWB News Talk 98. KFWB News Talk 980. This is Dr. Chambers on the Call. We have a special show today, and in the studio we have Dr. Barry Friedberg. Dr. Friedberg is a renowned national expert on anesthesia. Before the break, we were talking about the 20th century accomplishments of anesthesia, and they were big. In the 20th century, we went from a phase of being afraid to operate on people to the point where pretty much everybody, no matter how sick they were, could get a general anesthetic. And we did this in several different ways. The first was we could monitor your blood pressure. So if things dipped down a little bit, we could correct it quickly. If you got a heart rhythm problem, and so your heart wasn't pumping the blood, we could fix it. And the last big thing that happened in the 20th century was a thing called a pulse oximeter. A little probe simply went on your finger, gave it a little beep, and it measured how much oxygen was going into you. So if you became hypoxic, if the oxygen dropped, the anesthesiologist could take big action and save your life. So now we're approaching the 21st century, and we've got a different set of problems. In Dr. Friedberg's book, Getting Over, Going Under, he talks about the 20th century was everything below the neck, and it was really about saving lives. In the 20th century, we've got different problems, and he classifies it as everything above the neck. What do you mean, Dr. Freeberg, by above the neck?
Above the neck refers to keeping all the mental marbles that you started your anesthetic journey with. You want to wake up the same personality, sense of humor, and memories intact, as well as surviving the anesthetic.
Now, a lot of people associate this with complex surgery, like you're going to have open heart surgery, you're having heart valve replaced, or aortic aneurysm. But I gather from your book you're saying this can happen with even relatively minor surgery, like breast augmentation or liposuction.
There are major and minor surgeries, but every anesthetic is a major adventure.
A major adventure. See, that's the word that kind of even sells chills into me. I'm sure a lot of our listeners would go, you know, adventure? I don't have an adventure when I'm getting have an operation. I want to get it and get home and be well again. So how are general anesthesia different from what you're advocating? What are we talking here?
We're talking about the same net result to the patient. The patient merely just wants not to hear, feel, or remember the surgery, and that can be accomplished several ways. The primary issue is that every patient who comes to surgery presents an anesthetic mystery. They want to know, how much drug does this individual patient require? And once you start using a brain monitor, that mystery becomes an open book test.
Okay, well, let's talk about, before we get into the brain monitor, when I was in medical school, some of the anesthetists used to say to us, you know, anesthesiology is a little bit like gourmet cooking. There's no real recipe. There's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You know, my mom is visiting at the moment, and she has a lot of these traditional dishes. And I want her to teach me some of them. And I go, well, how much of this do you, how much salt do you put in? Well, a pinch. You know how much it is. And then what about, you just put a little bit of that. And you can't learn cooking like that. But I always got the impression that anesthesia was a little bit like that. We're not quite sure what we're doing, but make sure you put enough in.
That was precisely how we did it in the 20th century. We always had to give you more than we thought you needed for fear of not giving you enough.
Well, I like to joke in your book when one of your colleagues says, I like giving my patients lots of drugs because it makes me feel good.
Precisely. He's treating his own anxiety, not necessarily what his patients need.
He doesn't want the patient to wake up and remember anything bad.
Right.
So there are a lot of hard points in medicine, and sometimes our listeners get confused about this. Generally speaking, in medicine, if something goes wrong, say with a pregnant woman, there's a million people who want to investigate. They want to know why did a pregnant woman die. But in 21st century anesthesia, it's a little bit different. In the 20th century, people were dying. We went, oh my goodness, we've got to fix this blood pressure problem. We've got to fix this heart rhythm. But in the 21st century, you're talking about different problems. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, we're talking about the quality of your anesthetic survival. In other words, today, to this very day, the only mental evaluation you get when you're recovering from anesthesia is, can you move all four extremities on command? That's a very low level of brain function. Okay.
I don't know. There's a few people I know might find that hard, but that's another story.
Yes, exactly.
Go ahead. So when you wake up, they're going to monitor, can you lift all four limbs? Not a very good standard. When I was training in ICU, we had this, we were called to a cardiac arrest on a ward, and there was this young woman who came in who was 26, and she was having an AV fistula put in, which is a fairly minor procedure.
Yes.
Right? And she was admitted at noon on one day, and she had a little anesthetic, and we picked her up at an arrest at like 7 a.m. the following morning. And there was one crucial thing that I always told everybody when they were training and they were going through, because I was the chief resident. If a 26-year-old comes in and has an anesthetic and they're not talking to you after the surgery, there's a problem. And this young lady was profoundly hypoglycemic, and she wasn't diabetic, she wasn't on insulin, and we weren't quite sure why she ended up like that. There was some, we did a literature search with some blah, blah, blah about a renal failure. But the take-home message was, what, she woke up a little bit but not fully, and then she never fully recovered. And that was kind of odd to me that people wouldn't twig. Why isn't this young person awake? So what you're saying with 21st century anesthesia is that we should be looking for more subtle things. And
correct.
The subtle things are cognitive function. And that means, like, how is the person behaving?
Exactly. And one of the things they talk about now is postoperative cognitive dysfunction, POCD, which is the polite term for brain fog or delirium after anesthesia.
Well, this brain fog is well recognized after open heart surgery, but you're telling me it could happen to a woman who's in her 40s having her augmentation redone. Is that correct?
Correct. It happened to this gentleman from Canada, the 57-year-old, who had a 40-minute meniscectomy on his knee.
Meniscectomy was they were removing that little meniscus.
Little piece of cartilage.
Cartilage that was causing the pain in his knee?
Simple outpatient procedure, 40 minutes, and they over-medicated him, and he suffered serious long-term consequences.
Okay. So let's just go through the very basic things, and we talk about the brain monitoring. So when you want to give somebody an anesthetic, what are you trying to do? You're not trying to put them asleep, clearly. What are you doing?
Well, there's two portions of the anesthesia. There's the sleep portion and there's the pain relief portion. The technical terms are hypnosis and analgesia, but basically it's like a yin and a yang. And no matter which way you put those together, you must create the circumstances where the patient doesn't hear, feel, or remember the operation. The patient isn't interested in how many drugs you know how to use. They just want that simple function from you. And they want to wake up with their same personality, sense of humor, and memories intact.
That's not unreasonable.
No, that's the 21st century standard of care.
Okay. So how do you achieve this? You're using drugs that are slightly different than what a lot of other people are using.
Yes, more and more people are using propofol-based anesthesia because of its obvious superiority to the other drugs.
So propofol, most of us were not familiar with that, who were outside the business, except when there was a pop star recently who died from it. So... And what a lot of us were puzzled about, who even knew what propofol was why you would take this. So tell our listeners what exactly it is.
Propofol is a pure sleep drug. And one of the things I learned just this very year is that you get your normal amount of REM sleep or dream sleep when you have propofol for long procedures or, in that pop star's case, for a lengthy sleep at night. So when you wake up, you feel really good.
So, I mean... REM sleep is when you're dreaming, and that's the most important part of sleep. And it takes you a while when you're sleeping to get into that part of it. And the more REM sleep you have, the better. And we know from many years of experience that if you deprive people of sleep, that if you wake them up every time they start hitting REM sleep, they will become psychotic. So it's extremely important. So if you're stressed and burnt out, propofol would be a good drug to get into that REM sleep and make you relaxed.
And it's precisely the opposite of our old sleep drug, pentothal or thiopental, which deprive people of REM sleep. So amongst the other qualities that propofol has, it's a happy drug. It's an anti-inflammatory, but most importantly, it gives you restful sleep. So when you wake up, you don't have hangover.
So propofol, when it came out on the market, was horrendously expensive.
Yes, one of the many reasons I was criticized.
Okay, but now it's generic, so it's more freely available.
Yes.
So this is the mainstay of drug that so-called puts you to sleep.
Correct. It is a pure sleep drug.
Okay. Now, of course, the problem with all of these drugs is they don't just put you to sleep so that you have a nice little sleep like a baby. If you're not properly monitored, we have problems. And precisely. What kind of problems do we have?
Typically what happens is your jaw relaxes and the tongue falls to the back of the throat, which means the good air doesn't go in and the bad air doesn't go out. And so if somebody is watching and monitoring you, they can intervene to reestablish what we call your airway and allow that breathing exchange to happen and keep you alive and keep you from being damaged.
And actually, the intervention is very easy to do, and I think both of us have done it many times in our life. But the trick is you got to be monitoring the patient. You got to keep your eye on them, maybe have a little pulse oximeter there from the 20th century measuring how much oxygen they have. So this is a drug, of course, that should only be used in one setting.
Correct, in a medically supervised setting, properly monitored and properly observed.
Okay. So, but we can understand why this pop star was using it. It is a happy drug. It is a drug that gives you this great sleep.
And restful, you feel rested and woke when you wake up without a hangover.
Oh, I like the sound of that, but you're listening to Dr. Chambers on Call. I'm Talk Radio's Medicine. We have a special show today. In the studio, live with me is Dr. Barry Friedberg. Dr. Friedberg's new book is Getting Over Going Under. It's a book about how to survive anesthesia and how to optimize your chances for being exactly as you are after the surgery as you were before the surgery. Stay with us. We have more questions for Dr. Friedberg when we return. KFWB News Talk 980. KFWB News Talk 980. You're listening to Dr. Chambers on Call. I am Dr. Chambers, Talk Radio's Medicine. We have a special show for you today. In studio, we have a special guest, Dr. Barry Friedberg, MD. Dr. Friedberg is the author of Getting Over, Going Under, 5 Things You Must Know Before You Get an Anesthetic. Now, the proceeds from Dr. Friedberg's book is being donated to who, Dr. Friedberg?
The nonprofit Goldilocks Anesthesia Foundation.
And who are the Goldilocks anesthesia people?
We are dedicated to bringing the message to the public. It's a public education message that you don't have anesthesia without a brain monitor.
And the brain monitor, what actually are we monitoring with the brain monitor?
Your individual response to our anesthetic drugs.
And what does that? How does that help the anesthetist?
Well, it's no longer a question of giving you more drug than we think is necessary for fear of giving you too little. There's no longer the nefarious practice of routine over-medication, and we all worry about dementia, and over-medication can lead to dementia.
So what we want to do for the patient is we want to give them the right amount of drug for the shortest period of time because they'll have the minimum, the least amount of side effects.
Precisely. Not too much, not too little, okay. Just the right amount.
So if we give them too much, they're going to have some brain cognitive function. In simple terms, their memory will go. They won't perform socially as well. They won't perform their jobs as well. And this is a common problem, not just with major surgeries like open heart, but also with relatively, and I put that in quotes, relatively simple surgeries like cosmetic stuff. Would that be correct?
Absolutely correct.
And what you had a great phrase earlier that there's no such thing. There's major and minor surgery, but there's no
minor anesthesia.
So when we have the brain monitor on the patient, we're looking at certain waves. The individual for that patient. Now, in your book, you had that wonderful story about two different kinds of people. I thought this would illustrate what you're talking about. Maybe you could tell us that little story.
Sure. The average patient takes between 25 and 50 micrograms per kilogram per minute. And I titrated this one woman off to sleep who told me the last time she'd had propofol, she slept for 2 days. And sure enough, she wound up taking 1/10 of my low average dose. And I could barely keep her at the lower range. At the end of 6 hours, she woke up and said, fantastic, I never heard, felt, or remembered a thing. 6 weeks later, I had another gentleman who took 3 times my high average. So it was a 60-fold variation. And yet, he had the same 6-hour experience. At the end of that, he woke right up and said, great, I never heard, felt, or remembered a thing.
And that's what we want. We want you to remember nothing, have no pain, wake up not nauseated, not puking. And we want you to have the same kind of, be the same kind of person you were after the anesthesia as you were before the anesthesia.
Precisely. Now, that is the 21st standard of care, 21st century standard of care.
Well, there is some of the criticism of your technique is that you tend to operate primarily on people who are single system. In other words, they're not that sick and they're relatively young, as opposed to like a big teaching hospital where there's a lot of complex people with multi-system disease. They're diabetic. They've got heart disease. They've got blah, blah, blah. And their anesthesia is a little bit different. Would you agree with that or disagree with that?
Well, yes, their anesthetic may be different, but their brain is still the target organ. So if you're not measuring what you're medicating, then you're still out in left field with a recipe that may or may not work for that individual patient. The brain monitor allows you to titrate to the individual. I did a 95-year-old woman in a dental sedation situation and was able to carry her without problem for 4 or 5 hours, and she did just beautifully.
Okay. So we're going to focus on kind of the risk of anesthesia and what the patient should know, what the person should know before they get the anesthetic. Like, you know the big thing? There was a great Hollywood movie some years ago. I'm dating myself here, that had Paul Newman playing a lawyer, a drunken lawyer who gets his comeback, his redemption through a malpractice lawsuit. And it was directed by the great, I just blanked on it. It'll come to me in a second, but it's called The Verdict.
Yes.
And and my producer just whispered in my ear, of course, it was the great legendary, recently passed Sidney Lumet, who directed The Verdict, a movie I would highly recommend. This young woman had an anesthetic. She's going to have a C-section. And she lied, or unless, no, she didn't lie, but somebody recorded when she ate, so they gave her the wrong drug. Why is that so important? Why is it so dangerous to eat before an anesthetic?
Well, in the traditional scheme of anesthesia, we give muscle relaxants and narcotics that can cause nausea and vomiting. And so if you vomit and inhale that contents of your stomach into your lungs, chances are good to excellent, you're going to die.
What most people don't understand is you take that stuff, that aspirin, all the goop that's in your tummy, which is full of acid, you put that in the lungs, you get a nasty, nasty pneumonia. One of the things that always struck me when I was in doing ICU work was we pump people full of charcoal. The charcoal would end up in the lungs. Well, they almost certainly didn't have any problems, but a little bit of regular stomach stuff, and boy, you are really, really sick and end up what we call a multi-system organ failure scenario. Are there other things that the average person should know or should talk about before they have their anesthesia?
Yes. The demand for a brain monitor is a non-negotiable demand. And the only way you get people's attention is to kick them in the wallet. So this is a discussion you have with your surgeon, and you get from your surgeon the ability to contact the people who are giving your anesthesia and make your desires known.
Well, do you think that every person should meet their anesthetist before they have the surgery?
Well, you will, but it's usually while you're lying on the gurney waiting to go down the hallway. You want to have contact with them before you're admitted to the hospital, and if you can't meet that individual anesthesiologist, you want to discuss it with the person who makes the assignments.
Okay. So But if you're having, well, does that apply to every kind of surgery?
Absolutely.
Okay, and what about endoscopy?
No. It's a very short procedure, and it's very hard to give you enough medicine in the short duration of endoscopy to really hurt you.
Would that include a colonoscopy?
Correct.
Okay. And what about in the last 10 years, or actually longer, we have moved surgery from a hospital setting really to clinic setting. And on this show, we're always scared because we're trying to advise people to go to the best place. And I always tell people, look, when you go to see a surgeon who says, I can do this operation on you, my complication rate is this. And they're often quoting the best in the world literature. It's like you meet a filmmaker and he says, films gross 100 million per weekend. That's Steven Spielberg. I want to know what you gross. So I always tell my listeners, ask them what his complication rate is. So how do you know what outpatient clinic is licensed? Is there a license? How do you monitor these centers?
It's actually called accreditation, and there's four accrediting bodies in California. There's the Medicare people, there's the AAAHC, the Quad A, and IMQ. So you certainly want to ask if the office is accredited, which means it meets minimum safety standards. There's oxygen, ambu, and suction. There's a crash cart and a defibrillator to take care of emergencies. Those are your basics.
Okay. So let's put that in perspective for our audience. What we're trying to say is that if there's a crisis in that clinic, first off, they have the right equipment. An ambu will be an ambu bag, like a little airway. They put over your nose, they can squeeze some oxygen in. Very, very basic stuff. And, of course, that the staff are trained. Now, can you have a clinic without being accredited?
Yes, but that puts you at greater risk because you may not have those basic emergency equipment there.
Right. But there are clinics out there today operating in California without this accreditation. That's what you're telling me.
Yes. Mostly they will do cases under local anesthesia only, though. Once you surrender your consciousness, the state requires you to have some level of certification.
Because we've heard some really scary stories about the liposuction and about the lap bands, but some of these centers are not capable of looking after you when you get really sick.
Precisely.
Okay. All right. We're going to move on a little bit. The one section of your book that I liked was how to talk to your doctor, how to approach your doctor. And it was a little piece on, I think it was CBS News I caught on the way in, and this woman talked about when you're shopping for a doctor, it's a bit like getting shoes. You should make sure it's a comfortable fit, you like them, they're your style, it fits everything. And sometimes I read these stuff, and like last Sunday we did a segment on our show about how to fire your doctor or how to recognize it's time to say bye-bye to your doctor and get a new one. But in your book, you had some very practical advice. One of the things I really liked was don't go angry to your doctor. Don't go loaded with lots of things. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. You have to approach this person as the intelligent person that they know that they are. You're not going to browbeat somebody into doing something that they don't want to do. But you have a certain list of things that you want to discuss with them, and those can be found on the website as well, in detail as well as in the book.
And what's your website?
drbarryfriedberg.com. Or you can just Google Dr. Barry Friedberg and you'll get there too.
And what is the take-home message that you want everybody to understand? That there's no minor surgery and you have rights as a patient. What are those rights?
The rights are to make sure that nobody plays Russian roulette with your brain. You don't surrender your consciousness for a surgery without having a brain monitor.
And the brain monitor enables people to give you the correct amount of drug.
Right. Not too much or too little.
Because if it's too much, what we're finding is
delirium, dementia, and one death a day from anesthesia over medication.
One death a day.
Yes.
Now, there are millions and millions of surgeries every day in the United States.
Well, 40 million a year.
40 million a year.
So, and the number is very small, but again, as we talked about before, if it's you or a loved one, that over a $20 sensor, it's a ridiculous proposition.
Yes. I mean, I deal with this all the time in my professional life. Here on the radio, we're always talking about it really doesn't matter if it happens to you. If you're the one person that the zebra bites, you've got bitten.
It's 100%.
Okay. Well, Dr. Friedberg's book is Getting Over, Going Under, 5 Things You Must Know Before Anesthesia. You can get it on Amazon. It's freely available. There's a Kindle version. It's out there if you want it. Google his name. Get on his website. There's some handouts on his website that will help you understand what we were talking about today. Dr. Friedberg, I want to thank you for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.